I've been asked by a number of people to do an introductory tape. On the subject of hermeneutics. I feel I cannot do better than take the following from one of the writings of Mr. Eugene Halliday entitled Five Things to Do. Here then is the introduction. So, five things to do. What are they? Why should we do them? And for whom? Well, the first thing to do, obviously, is to exist. For if we don't exist, we obviously can't do the other four. And we know that we exist, firstly, because we have a physical body. Second thing to do, the one we've been looking at, is to feel. For if we do not feel, we cannot use our existence to the best advantage. And feeling is the basis of our awareness that we exist and do whatever we do. And by this feeling, as we've just seen, we become aware that the things we do bring pleasure or pain of some degree. In general, and apart from certain instances, which we'll deal later, when we feel pleasure, our body's circulation is being helped by a relatively gentle play of energies. And when we feel pain, our body's circulation is being impeded because of tensions or contractions induced by a too violent action of energies. And the third thing we do is to think about our existence and our feelings. So if I slap my leg, I feel the leg more intensely than the one I didn't slap. I'm aware first of the sensation then of, say, the physical body. Then how I feel about the slap. And the third one, I can think about the sensation, how I feel, and whatever results from my thinking about it. So that's the third thing to do. We think about our existence and our feelings. So by our thinking about things, we become aware of how they're made, how they're formed, what materials they're made of, what characteristics and what action tendencies they have. And when we've thought carefully about things, we can see clearly their shapes, as we've said, materials, quantities, qualities, the ways of acting in themselves as they are and separately from other things outside them. And it is useful for us to remember that all things that come into contact with each other interact in some way or other. Even if their interaction is not very obvious. Everything in the universe is in a state of interaction with everything else. Now, the fourth thing to do is to understand the relationships that exist between things that we thought about, their characteristics and ways of action and interaction. The difference between thinking and understanding is that in thinking we can concentrate our consciousness on things in isolation from other things, but in understanding we hold things together in our mind, make clear to ourselves how their forms are similar or dissimilar, their modes of action similar or dissimilar. And how all these necessarily interact with each other to produce the various effects of things we see in the world around us. That's the difference between understanding and thinking. So, okay, we've got exist, feel, think, understand. And the fifth thing to do is to use our will. Will is that power in us which can change the direction of our action. It can start a new movement of our body, which can deliberately control our ideas and pattern them in new ways. Will can also deliberately strengthen and reinforce our ways of thinking and feeling and doing. Or it can oppose them and bring them to a halt, as when we deliberately concentrate our energies onto an idea that something is unprofitable to us. And so stop the action which would otherwise result. So there are the five things for us to do: to exist, feel, think, understand, will. And if we do these, we shall make the best life possible in this world, or any other. So let's examine the five in a little more detail. What do we mean when we say that we exist? Well, firstly, we mean that we have a body which is made of a certain amount of matter, which is located in space and can move or be moved about from place to place. If we say of anything, does it exist? We verify or prove its existence by seeing if it occupies a certain amount of space. And if we cannot locate anything whatever in a certain place in space, we say there's nothing there. And when we locate a thing in space, we say there is something there which we call matter, and that this matter is the body of the thing. Now, we know in the 19th century it was believed that matter was made of solid particles which couldn't be broken into smaller parts, and these particles were called atoms, which simply means uncuttable substances. But in our own century, the 20th, we've discovered that matter is not made of unbreakable particles, but of energy. And this is no longer a mere theory, but a proven fact by exploding the atom. Now we live not in an age of solid material bits or particles, but of energies. And this is very important for us, and especially of the view of the universe in which we live. The old world of pure materialism is now proved to be an erroneous idea. The exploding of the atom has blown the old, too simple materialism to pieces. The world we live in is an energy world. And all the bodies in it, including our own living bodies, are made of energy and not of solid bits of matter. And that our bodies are made of energy is so important of our view of the world that we really cannot remind ourselves of it too often. And especially important is it for those of us who take religion seriously. For if the old idea of matter as made of solid particles is false, then the old idea of materialism is also wrong. Atheists have always been fond of the idea of solid unbreakable particles of matter, because if such solid unbreakables existed, then there would be no room for God. We'll use this word God. It's the most effective, to my mind, shorthand term for referring to an absolute infinite field of intelligent power. We'll shorthand it to God. And if this were true, then the statement that God is everywhere, that is, if there were solid unbreakable particles of matter, then the statement that God is everywhere would be untrue, for he would not be inside solid material atoms. So the atheists, if they could accept the idea of solid matter, had something in which they could hide from the idea of God. For them, the solid atom became the proof that God does not exist. For as God had been said to be everywhere, if the atoms were solid and so stopped God being in them, then effectively there was no God at all. A God that is not everywhere, said the atheists, was not effectively a God at all, and so might as well be given up. Saying this, the atheists could then move about in the world and do in it whatever they felt like doing. For if there was no God, then there must be no divine law, no spirituality, nothing but material bodies moving about, sometimes colliding with each other, making temporary patterns, at other times moving at random through space with nothing to govern them. Accident being lord of the world. But with the proof that matter is not made of unbreakable solid particles, the atheist's chief stronghold has been destroyed. In a universe made of energy, there are no solid particles, no bits of matter where that field cannot penetrate. God's everywhereness, his omnipresence, is not disproved by a world made of energy. In fact, we may come to see later, because all forms of energy are interchangeable, the presence of God, or this field power, this intelligent field power, becomes realizable in the five things that man can do. If the universe is a great ocean of energy, and if matter is only a form of energy, which, remember, is now accepted and proven scientifically and beyond doubt, then the five things we can do are all forms of energy. Behavior patterns of power. Our physical body is a complex form of energy. Our feeling is a kind of energy experience. Our thinking is an energy process. Our understanding is an interrelating energy pattern. And our will is energy itself acting as cause of the appearance of new energy erections or the reinforcing and restatement of old ones. The law that all forms of energy are interchangeable is of the utmost importance for us. For by this law is explained how miracles are possible, how body can give rise to feeling, how feeling can interact with body and the thinking process, and how the thinking process can be related to understanding, and how the will can interact with all levels of our being so that we may change our energy processes on all levels, affect our health, and create our destiny. With our will and understanding, we can fight against wrong thinking processes, against slavery to feelings of pleasure and pain, against the unwillingness and inertness and habit bondage of our body. And as the battle goes our way and our will and understanding overthrow our wrong thinking, we begin to see pleasure and pain in a new way. Then we become able to bring our body into a truer way of functioning, brought into service of the will and understanding. Not only of ourselves, but of perhaps this creative force that we have been seeing by the shorthand word God. Then we shall begin to know why we should do five things and for whom. Feeling is the basis of all our knowledge of ourselves and everything in the universe in which we exist. It comes from an old English word meaning to touch or to pluck. In other words, we use to convey a similar meaning is sensation, which is taken from the Latin sentire, which means to feel, to know. If we touch one of our fingers with our thumb, we feel it as offering a certain amount of resistance to the pressure of our thumb, We say we have a sensation of resistance. We may also have a sensation of the texture of the skin of the finger, smooth or rough in some degree. Or we can feel the finger to be warm or cold, hard, soft, so on. We can also look at the finger and see its shape and the colour. We can smell it, if we like, put it in our mouth and taste it. Tap it on the table, listen to the noise that results from the tapping. All these things we can do give us some kind of information about the finger and the way we can use it. By using it in different ways, we gain different sensations or feelings or knowledge. But there's one special thing we have to note about our feelings. We not only get information about the way things are shaped or textured, rough, smooth, hard, soft, warm, cold, we also experience in our feelings something we call like and dislike, pleasure and displeasure. And this is one of the most important facts of which we can become conscious. If we knock our finger hard on the corner of the table, we can feel pain. Pain. Pain means something we would rather refuse than accept. And if we gently stroke the painful finger, we can reduce its pain and feel pleased so to do. So pleasure is something we tend to accept rather than refuse. This simple division of feelings into pleasurable ones and painful ones is of tremendous importance, far beyond what is immediately obvious. Some philosophers and psychologists are so impressed by the power of pleasures and pains to condition human behavior that they believe that human beings, like animals, have no freedom of will and must move towards pleasurable things and away from painful ones. They say that free will is nonsense, that human beings in a simple situation will always move towards a pleasurable thing and away from an unpleasurable or painful one, and that in a complicated situation there's a rapid reaction to all its pleasures and pains and resultant movement towards the least painful action solution within the whole situation. By this kind of argument, no human being has ever done anything except on the basis of a reaction to a complicated pleasure-pain situation. Here there's no freedom whatever. The pleasures of a situation pull us towards them. The displeasures and pains push us away. And we finally move in the direction of most pleasure and least displeasure. If this were true, then our life would be nothing but a wandering process between pleasurable and unpleasurable situations. And as all situations are complex and contain both pleasure and unpleasure, we would never be able to attain any ultimate satisfaction. But if it were true that pleasures and pains were the only determinants of our life actions, then we would be in no sense essentially different from the animals. We'd have no more control over our lives than they have. All our superiority, if you like, over the animal world, and all our human dignity, would be an illusion. There'd be no free choice. All would depend on the accidental pleasures and pains that we had suffered. If the stimulus that acted upon us caused pleasure, we would be compelled to move towards it. If it caused displeasure or pain, we would be compelled to move away from it. And the degree of pleasure or pain would determine the speed or our motion towards or away from it. But if we feel very carefully inside ourselves, and we are in a complicated situation, and all situations have some degree of complexity, we find there is a calculation process going on inside our mind. A process in which, though pleasures and pains may be under consideration, these are not the only facts that we think about. Here is where those who believe in the pleasure-pain theory of human action have to refine their definitions of what constitutes pleasure and pain. If we knock our knuckles hard on the table, we feel, if we are normal in our response, a pain of some degree of intensity. Because the occasion of the pain was a physical knock, we call the pain a physical pain. If we gently stroke the painful place till pain subsides, we experience the diminishing of the pain and say the physical pain has been reduced. If we gently stroke different parts of our physical body, we experience a degree of pleasure and call it physical pleasure. If we stroke a cat, it tends to purr. If we tickle behind a dog's ear, it tends to lean upon our fingers to increase the pleasure. All these pleasures we call physical. And we don't often expect animals to react in any other way. But we human beings react not only to physical situations, which are the causes of pleasures and pains, which we call physical, we react also to mental situations. That is, to thoughts, to groups of ideas. And we react to inner feelings and emotions, to urges and impulses, all of which affect our thoughts. Long ago, Socrates said that the unexamined life is not worth living. He meant, of course, not worth living for human beings. He didn't expect animals to examine their lives, to think about their relationships with each other, to construct philosophies to govern those relations. When we human beings react to our inner processes of thought and feelings and urge, we do so in a way the animals cannot and do not. We react to our inner pleasures and pains in a very complex way. Even when we are in a physical situation which gives us no pain at all, we can feel pain. This is very important. We can feel pain at the mere memory of things we've done. Or, even more surprisingly, at the mere thought of things we have no intention of doing, but which we think we ought not to do, ought not even to think of doing. So why is this? Something very strange about we human beings. When we have no physical pains, we can actually feel mental pain. Even when we are experiencing physical pleasures, we can feel mentally ill at ease. And whenever we feel this mental lack of ease, it causes us a different kind of problem to the kind we have when we have a merely physical pain. This is very important, very important. When we have a merely physical pain, we can consider its cause to be outside our own essential inner self. Listen to that bit again. If we have a toothache, we can think to ourselves, this toothache is the result of decay in the tooth. We don't think to ourselves, I am bad, but the tooth is bad. If we have an appendicitis, we don't say, I am inflamed, but we say, my appendix is inflamed. We think that our tooth, or our appendix, is something outside our essential self. But if we have a mental pain, say from a thought or a feeling that we believe is wrong for us to have, this mental pain seems somehow more intimately related to our own inner self, more deeply inside our being. We feel that somehow a mental pain has more to do with us as responsible human beings than any external pain of physical origin. If mental pain becomes intense, we tend to believe that there is something wrong. Not merely with our physical body, but with our own inner being, our own real self, our soul.
we tend to feel guilty. Guilty. That is, to feel that we have ourselves done something wrong.
Now, what's the origin of this feeling? What do we mean when we say we have done something wrong? Well, we can mean that we've done something inefficiently. As when we try to perform some act or skill and do it less than perfectly. We might try to play a piece of music and fail to give it the feeling or interpretation we think would do it justice. Or we can mean that we've made a mistake, as when we add up a column of figures and get a result which on checking we find incorrect. Or we can mean that we've done something that's put us out of relation with other human beings. And this, for us, is the most important meaning of the word wrong. To feel that we've done something that has put us out of relation with other human beings. Because whatever mistakes we may make, or however efficiently we may do a thing, or the things we have to do, it's only if these mistakes and inefficiencies put us out of relation with each other that they make us feel guilty. Guilt is the feeling we have when we believe that we have done something that has broken our relationship with other human beings, with our family, or friends, or others who might be necessary for our welfare. Guilt is the feeling that we have, by our own will, placed ourselves in a position where we are no longer acceptable to the people with whom we have to live. So behind guilt, there is a process of feeling and thought having its origin in the communal relationships of human beings over many thousands of years. That's worthy of considerable meditation. Let's now consider the third thing we have to do, to think about our existence and our feelings, to think. To think is to examine in our mind the shape of things, the materials they're made of, characteristics, ways of action, relationships of all these. That's when we think. We're examining things in our mind. And notice the word think and thing are closely related. When we get an image of a thing in our mind, we have a think about it. This think we call an idea. An idea is a mental image of a thing. Idea means shape or form. Now, children and primitive people tend to think in images and to play with these images in their imagination. Imagination is that mental activity in which we manipulate images. We can play with the images in our minds, toy with ideas, as we say. Sometimes the ideas we play with give us pleasure. At other times, certain games we play in our imagination give us unpleasure or displeasure. We can even frighten ourselves with our mental images of what might happen to us. This is part of the way we have of controlling ourselves, by imagining unpleasant things that might happen to us if we allow ourselves to do certain things. Now, as we become older, we tend to substitute words for mental images. And the reason for this substitution is one of economy. That is, we save time and energy
by using the name of something, instead of making a complete mental image of that thing. Obviously, to use the name of a friend in conversation is much more convenient than having to make a fully detailed mental image of him before we can talk about him. So, also with the things that we use in our daily lives. And not only the things that we use, but also the relations between these things and ourselves. And between ourselves and other persons. We can see that relations between things are rather more difficult to describe than the things themselves. And relations between persons are even more difficult to describe. And relations between relations are even more difficult to describe. And the most difficult of all to describe are relations between the relations between persons. To see how a glass is related to the drink it holds is fairly easy, and how a cup is related to a saucer or a knife to a fork. These are also easy to see. But if we take a more abstract relation, say that of the relation between conservatism and socialism, or either of these, and liberalism, it's less easy to say precisely what we mean by it. Then if we decide to examine the relation between the mental image we have of a public figure and the way this public figure pictures himself to himself, well, we're in very deep water. And it's very convenient to use names of things and persons and names of relations between things and persons instead of making complicated mental images of them. But as with all conveniences, there are also inconveniences. It's all right to economize our time and energy by using words instead of images, but only if our words correspond with facts of reality. And often, as we know only too well, they do not. If they did, then innumerable misunderstandings that are in the world of human relations would not exist and would not cause us so much distress. To think clearly, we must first see clearly. We must perceive the things of the world as they really are, in their shapes, their materials, their properties, their qualities and ways of acting, the relations between all these things. We must use our sense organs, our sight, our hearing, our smelling, tasting, touching. And we must see how things interact, how one affects another. And when we're thinking, we are manipulating ideas in our mind, either of things and persons and the relations between these, or words which represent to us these things and persons and relations. If we manipulate these ideas correctly, that is, in ways of corresponding to the true nature of things and persons and relations, then we have a good chance of being able to relate in a good way to the real things, persons and relations, which our ideas represent. But if we mishandle our ideas of things and persons and relations as they exist in our mind, then there's a high probability that we will also mishandle the reality of the things these ideas represent. We cannot do ourselves a better service than make ourselves very, very clear about this fact.
only if our ideas correspond with facts and we handle our ideas correctly will we be able to handle the facts themselves. So clear thinking, the third thing we have to do, is essential for happy, efficient living. Thinking about things is not so difficult as thinking about the relations between things. Thinking about persons is very different to thinking about things. And thinking about the relations between persons requires a high degree of sensitivity. Human beings are persons, that is, essentially intelligent beings with consciousness and feelings and will, all of which are involved in their responses to each other and to the things of the world in which they live and move. To disregard these three functions in human beings is to be out of contact with reality, and so to fail to make allowances for the highly complex patterns of action that exist amongst them. How is it that these three functions that we all share in common should show in us so many differences of character and action? It's because these three functions, so similar in all of us, register in our beings the differences of the environments in which we live and develop. Though our faculties of thought and feeling and will are very similar, yet the environments in which we gain our experience are not identical and cannot be. Thus, our experiences cannot be identical. Even in the same environment, we cannot see the same things from the same viewpoint simultaneously. In order that our experiences should be identical in all respects, we'd have to see the same things from the same viewpoints, in the same order throughout our whole life, which is obviously impossible. The basis of all our thinking is in the experiences we undergo in life. If our experiences differ, which they must do, then the content of our thinking must differ also. And because of these facts, we shall find it helpful if we make allowances for each other's differences of response to the different things and events of the world. If we make insufficient allowances for each other's different responses, we shall not be able to maintain harmonious relationships with each other, and we'll find that we've become estranged from each other. And when we find ourselves estranged or alienated from each other, we often tend to try to justify ourselves, to find some explanation of our alienation which will relieve us of responsibility for it. To justify is to balance. The justification we seek is the balance of all the energies which make up our being, and especially the balance of our mental energies. Because as human beings, we tend to live a large part of our lives within our minds, in our thinking processes. If two human beings disagree about something, and the disagreement reaches high intensity, it's usual for each to try to prove the other wrong. By this means, each one tries to place the responsibility for their estrangement from each other onto the other one. If one proves the other wrong, or appears to do so, then the one proved wrong feels uncomfortable. The imposed feeling of wrongness carries with it a feeling of guilt. Guilt. And guilt, as we've seen, is the feeling that we have done something wrong,
and especially that we have alienated or estranged ourselves from other human beings, that we've made ourselves unacceptable to them. And here is where we must think very clearly. If we have made ourselves unacceptable to our fellow human beings, what will happen to us? Our life is meaningful only if we are able to function properly, to use all the parts of our being in actual relationships, and for this we need other than our own isolated self. We cannot actualize all our possibilities of life and action except in relationship with other human beings. And this fact is of very great importance. We all know what it means to be deliberately ignored by our fellows, to be sent to Coventry for some real or imaginary wrong. And we know this can make us very uncomfortable because we need relationships with our fellows in order to be able to live our lives to the full. But we also know that in history there have been many men and women who've been cast out from the society of their day only to appear later in the history books as heroes and martyrs. We know, therefore, that to be rejected by our fellows is no absolute proof that we are wrong in our thoughts, feelings, words, or deeds. Because of this, it's very necessary for us to teach ourselves to be clear in our thoughts, to be strictly truthful with ourselves about our relationships with each other. And if we begin to differ with others in our views about things, instead of leaping immediately to self-justification and vigorous proving of our opponent's wrongness, it's our first duty to remember that the different views of other people are not necessarily the proof of their wrong-headedness or stupidity or ill will, but possibly a proof merely of their basically different experiences of life, of education, of temperament or origin. So what we need above all things in our relationships with each other is the clear understanding of the origins of our differences of viewpoint, temperament, character, and action. And this understanding we cannot get unless we make ourselves think clearly. And to think clearly, we must first perceive things as they really are, in themselves and their relationships with each other. Then we must make ourselves aware of our feeling bias and the feeling bias of others, our likings and dislikings, and the likings and dislikings of others. Then we must make allowances for the differences in our viewpoints and feeling biases. We must recognize that we are all somehow involved together in the lives that we live. For in this recognition, we will find the key to the mutual forgiveness, which will lead us on and into the realm of the fourth thing that we have to do, and that is to understand. And to understand so fully that all our thinking will become lit with a new kind of light that will enable us to see the whole reality as it is, and show us our real place and purpose within it. So what is understanding? If a small child had never before seen bluebells growing in a wood, and had been in that wood before the bluebells had grown, the child might not be able to account for their presence, might even be prepared to believe that the bluebell fairies had put them there. On the surface of things, there would be nothing to account for them. But if we were to dig down below the surface of the soil, we would reveal that standing underneath the visible bluebells were some bulbs from which the flowers had grown. To understand is to know what is standing underneath the visible things we see. To comprehend the relation between visible effects and invisible causes. An effect is a fact that is visible to us, or that we can know about through our sense organs. We know about effects, that is, external facts, by seeing or hearing them, by touching, tasting, or smelling them. And to know our external facts, we use our five physical sense organs. But to understand these facts, we must stand underneath these sense organs. We must go beneath our sense organs, which are exposed to the outer world. We must descend into our brains, study the deeply stored records of our previous relevant experiences. This is why, when we try to understand things, we often turn our attention away from the outer world and use whatever we can find in our memories that is related to what we want to understand. So when we try to understand things, we're really looking for causal relationships. So what is cause? Quite simply, a cause is a power, the action of which brings some effect, and which in the absence of this power would be absent. The word cause comes from a Latin word meaning to strike, to beat, to knock. The whole visible, tangible universe is an effect of invisible power. We do not see this causal power, we see only its effects. To quote from St. Paul, from the things visible, we know the things invisible. Some people think that we can see causes. For example, if a car knocks down a man and injures him, they think they've seen the cause of the man being knocked down. In fact, what they've seen is not the cause. All they see is the light reflected from the car, not the power of the car. If a black eye follows from the blow of a fist, the reflected light from the fist by which we see the fist is not the cause of the black eye. Scientists who are very busy seeking the cause of things are really seeking to know the power that brings things into being. Scientists know that all matter is energy, that physical bodies are energy masses. But scientists, when they try to measure energy or power, cannot measure it directly. They have to use instruments with dials and fingers that move across them. They cannot see the power going through their instruments, their voltmeters. They can only see the effect of that power insofar as it induces a movement of the finger or needle over the dial of the instrument. Power itself, that is, real cause, is invisible. The experimental scientist does not bother himself much about this fact. After all, he's really only concerned with the manipulation of effects. As long as he's able to do this, he will be content to carry on with his experimental approach to the world in which he lives. But experimental science, by its mode of approach to the world, debars itself from the examination of the finer facts which lie in principle beyond the reach of his instruments. A scientist may examine material facts, including the movement of needles on his electrical instruments. He might even be able to examine a portion of his own brain by removing it, or having a brother scientist remove it for him, a portion of it. He might test its reaction to various kinds of stimuli, electric or electromagnetic. But however interesting his results, he cannot examine in this way his own self, his own soul. It's because of this fact that many scientists ignore man's innermost self or soul and prefer to think of man as simply a complicated kind of machine. But a true scientist does not prefer to believe anything. A true scientist has no preferences. He simply follows a trail of facts without bias, wherever they may lead him. And if finally he comes up against a fact which he cannot explain, he does not deny it to be a fact. He simply accepts it and hopes that somewhere, at some time, understanding will come to him. And there is nothing on earth more complex than a human being. His body alone has a complexity so great that science is only now beginning to touch some of its most important problems. For example, the problem of the transmission of characteristics of individuals from one generation to another. It's easy to say heredity, easy to say DNA, but what this means in terms of actual energy processes and their subtlest interrelations is still quite unknown. The 20th century is no nearer the solution of the problem of the origin of man's intelligence than was the 19th century. It's no good ignoring man's consciousness, his intelligence, his will, as do the mechanistic behaviourists who like to think of man as a rather complex organism which reacts to stimuli in certain unavoidable ways. Man's intelligence is that by which he designs, conducts his experiments on the things of the world, including his own body and brain. But man's intelligence, his consciousness and will, has never yet been directly observed by any of his external instruments. His consciousness and will can be examined directly only in one way. That is, by turning them upon themselves in an act of self-examination. Increasing recognition of this fact in our century has led to the growth of interest in the art of meditation, of yoga, and so forth. But although yoga as a term derives from India, the art of meditation has been practiced by intelligent men and women all over the world and in all ages. True enough, Indian yoga reached a very high degree of development in certain schools and recorded its findings in detail. But the generality of people in India were no more expert in the art than the generality of people in the rest of the world. Yoga, which has the same meaning as our word religion, means the joining of the consciousness of man back to his source, which philosophers call the absolute and religious people call God. The only difference in believing in the absolute and believing in God is that those who believe in the absolute think of it as a non-personal force, and those who believe in God think of him as a person. That is, a power which knows that it is a power. A power that's not only predictive of the universe, but is intelligently so by act of his, that is, God's will. So compared with God, the absolute is a cold proposition, an abstraction. And compared with this abstraction, God is a warm, living, intelligent, personal power whose creativity aims at the ultimate good of all his creatures. We can know intellectually what we mean by the absolute, but we cannot love it as such.
But we can know God in our heart, and Him we can love as He loves us. This is the distinction. Now, some people who call themselves rationalists think that it's silly or sentimental to believe that the cause of the universe is intelligent and has regard and consideration for its creatures. But such people are not so rational as they like to pretend. The life principle in them shows a very strong determination to preserve the forms it uses. And it's this life principle that has brought into being all the living forms that evolutionists like to study. It's this same life principle which is referred to in the Gospel of John, where it's clearly stated that life is in God, and that this life in God is the light of men. We often use the word light in ordinary conversation to refer to our understanding. We say, to quote, in the light of our understanding. Now, rationalists may say that this is only a figure of speech, and that our understanding has nothing, or at least very little, to do with light. But they'd be quite wrong. For a large part of human understanding is derived from the action of light on our eyes. And when we are thinking about things that we have seen and made mental images of them, we're using the same light energy stored up in our memory that we used to see those things in the first place. It's commonplace for scientists to say that all the forms of energy that we know can be converted into each other. Molecular energy, chemical energy, mechanical energy, electrical energy, radiational energy, field energy. If we want to see the first beginnings of all these, we have to look out into the night sky at the stars. Starlight is the star t. Star and start being related phonetically here. Starlight is the start of our existence. It's not surprising that in the pursuit of understanding, the most intelligent of men are still looking in the same direction. If our scientists can find out exactly what substance the stars are made of, they will have found out the first substance of man. Substance is what stands underneath all the phenomena of the universe. Hence, Fred Hoyle recently, when being interviewed by Patrick Moore, said, and this is to quote his actual words, "I have come," he said, "to the reluctant conclusion that life on Earth has come out of the light, and that the Earth itself started as light." Which means all the biologists are going to have to rethink and rewrite their textbooks, where they believe that life came out of the waters. The reluctant conclusion is that the medieval philosophers were right when they said that creation itself had come out of the light, out of the stars. So to gain real understanding, we must go down below all appearances, even below starlight, into the great unknown mystery of the boundlessness of God. "With all your getting, get understanding," said Solomon. And when we've got it, there's only one more thing for us to do. When we've got understanding, that final thing is to will. But what is will? We use the word often enough, but we don't often use it in the same sense, nor do we often define exactly what we mean by it. Sometimes by will we mean wish or want. As when we say, I will go to the theatre tonight, or I'll watch TV after I've finished my meal. Here we use will to mean our future intention, that is, our wish or want for some time ahead of us. But by will we also mean that power in us which we choose a course of action, and by which, once we've chosen that course, can compel ourselves to stick to it. By will we mean the power in us that enables us to choose a course of action, to reinforce our choice, to change our mind, to oppose our natural tendencies, to control our mental and emotional processes, to halt our actions at a given point, to concentrate our energies upon some goal, and to keep them concentrated in the face of all opposition till the goal is attained. Will, then, must be a very mysterious force, for it's able to act upon all our processes, physical, mental, and emotional. It's therefore not very surprising that philosophers and psychologists find the will a very difficult thing to deal with. Some psychologists even deny that man has any free will at all, which is strange, because if there's no such power, then the psychologist who writes a book to prove there's no free will should believe that he's not free to refuse to write it. In effect, he's saying that his book is written under an uncontrollable natural compulsion. If we test ourselves to see if we have any power to choose or to select a course of action, we shall find that for all practical purposes we can do so. For example, if we read a sentence and then ask ourselves if we can choose to read it again or to refuse to read it again, we can do so. For example, before I, the speaker, say anything on this tape, I can choose to continue to speak, or I can choose to replay back the piece that I've just put on. And you, the listener, if you care to join me in the experiment, can choose to do the same. Or you can refuse to do so, for any reason you care to invent. In either case, you'll experience a process inside you which we call the process of willing, either to cooperate with me or to refuse to do so, either to say yes to my request or to say no to it. Yes or no. These two short words, mere monosyllables, are the two most important words in the whole of our vocabularies. For by saying yes or no to whatever we're asked to do, we steer our life course. So to will is to choose to say either yes or no to any situation in which we may find ourselves, to any request made to us, to any demand made upon us, to any suggestion we may receive. To will is to choose to react to some stimulus in some particular way, to say yes to one course of action and no to another. Christ tells us very clearly to let our yea be yea and our nay nay. And not to be able to do this is to be in danger of that uncomfortable error we call indecision. To waver between alternative courses of action. To vacillate. To fail to move. Either towards our own good or away from evil. No one has ever seen the will itself. We see its effects in actions of the body. We feel its effects in the way it acts upon our emotional nature. We detect its action in the changes of direction in our thoughts, or in the persistence of some chosen central idea. But we never see the will itself. The will is an invisible, intangible power which determines our destiny. For will is our power of choice. In every situation in which we make a free choice, we use our will, our most mysterious power, to select from presented alternatives some course of thought, feeling or action. And what usually happens before we choose? We refer to our understanding of the situation in which we find ourselves. The fourth of these things to do, our understanding. We consult consciously or unconsciously the memories of all our experiences as we believe them to be relevant to our situation and purpose. Our unconscious consultation with these experienced memories result in what we call instinctive choices. Instincts, then, are really reasons for acting in particular ways. An instinct or instincts are reasons for acting in particular ways, and many of them inherited from our ancestors. The fact most important for the fulfillment of our real life purpose. Because our ancestors have not always willed the best course for the development of life. And where their will has chosen a wrong course, has begun a march in a wrong direction, we, their descendants, may find that our instinctive reactions to certain situations are not always those most profitable to us, physically, mentally, or spiritually. And because of this fact of our possible acquiescence in a wrong choice, made originally by some ancestor and later reinforced by others, we need a more reliable basis of choice than that offered to us by our instinctive reactions. This basis of choice must be absolute in its truth, beyond any possibility of error. A supreme, primary, eternal fact. Yet it must also be able to manifest in a world where untruth and error are frequently seen struggling to rule. In a world where time imposes its character. Where fashions strive to dictate what attitudes people shall take to the great questions of life. What is this absolutely true, unshakable, eternal basis of choice? Simply, this basis is love. love. But love for the past few thousand years has been the most misused word in our vocabularies. For it's been used in so many different senses. It's been used to stand for desire for material possessions. It's been used to mean desire for pleasurable stimuli. Stood for a desire to have a mind well stocked with interesting ideas. As when we might say, I love reading good books about intelligent subjects. Love's been used in all these ways, and many, many more. But there is another sense in which we can use the word love. The sense in which Jesus Christ used it. And this meaning is seldom used. Because it's seldom understood. For Christ, love means not desire, not wish, not want, but will, especially directed will, the will to work for the development of the best potentialities of all living beings. Now, if we accept the Christian doctrine, then we believe that the work of Christ Father, God, is the work of creation. Everything God does in the mysterious, unseen operation of his will. That Christ manifested openly in his life the will to create, the infinitely productive power which we call God, works invisibly in ways unknown to the lower mind of earth-bent man. But the Spirit of Christ penetrates to the centre of this eternal power, sees its creative will to bring ever more abundant life into the world. Here, and in this oneness with the creativity of God's will and the duplication of this will in the will of Christ, we have our eternal basis of choice for our will. For you could say that now we've reached the final meaning of the five things we have to do. First, we must exist. Then we must feel. Then think through all that we have done and felt. Then, understanding the relationships between all parts of our experience, we come finally to exercising our will, our power of choice. Understanding all that we do, we find ourselves in a position where we cannot do other than select some course of action or refuse to act. Now Christ says, it is my will to do the will of my Father who sent me. And to quote again, not my will, but thine, Father. The natural earth-bound part of us, our physical body and its fixed patterns of behaviour, our likings and dislikings, our love of comfort and hatred of pain, frustration, our habitual thinking processes tied to the ideas of material gain and loss, all these stand in opposition, both to our understanding and to our will. There's a real battle here. If you like, the battle for the soul of man. And this battle is fought inside our body, inside our mind and heart. Our whole being is the battlefield, in which we must, what's he called? Fight the good fight. Here we must take our stand within our very own beings. For here we unavoidably find ourselves in the world. We've no alternative but to will. either as Christ did, to do the will of God, our Father, our generative power, our causative field, or to refuse to do so. And between these two, we've no middle course. And once having understood this law of the excluded middle course, we cannot help seeing that at every moment of our lives, every moment, we have chosen to agree or to disagree with Christ and so with God. Then we stand where we can say and mean the Lord's Prayer's most important words. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Then we shall have done the five things we have to do. Then we stand where we can say and mean the Lord's Prayer's most important words. Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Then we shall have done the five things we have to do.